One day a buzzard fell out of the sky. The final words he spoke we can't deny. Whether man or bird or elephant, we will all become trace elements. Yes, we'll all turn to compost by and by. By and by.
Hello, K-Squid listeners. It's every other Sunday again, and this is Sustainability Now, a bi-weekly K-Squid radio show focused on environment, sustainability, and social justice in the Monterey Bay region, California, and the world. And tonight I'm your host, Ronnie Lipschitz. A new California law requires, as of the beginning of this year, that all jurisdictions in the state provide organic waste collection services to residents and businesses. According to the CalRecycle website, organic waste includes food, green material, landscape and pruning waste, organic textiles and carpets, lumber, wood, paper products, printing and writing paper, manure, biosolids, digestate, and sludges. The city of Santa Cruz has just announced what it is going to do about this law. Starting on the east side and spreading west, the city will distribute 6-gallon pails for food scraps to be collected during regular weekly curbside garbage and recycling pickup. While I have a backyard composting bin, I never look too closely into it. All I know is that I put food scraps in the top and take out heavy black soil from the bottom. To learn more about how to make compost, I took a trip out to Hardcore Compost on the west side of Santa Cruz, next to the Homeless Garden Project. There, I spoke with Kumi Maxson and Zav Hirschfeld, two members of the Hardcore worker-owned cooperative. Hardcore uses cargo bicycles to haul food scraps from home kitchens to their composting site. This interview was recorded outdoors in a not-too-quiet neighborhood. You'll be hearing various background noises, wind, birds, cars, electric saws. Try to ignore them. I'm here at Hardcore Compost on the west side of Santa Cruz, right next to the Homeless Garden Project. And I'm speaking today with two of the members of the worker-owned company, Hardcore Compost. Maybe you two can each introduce yourselves and tell us a little bit about your background.
Sure, I can start. My name is Zav Hirschfeld. I'm a 3-year member at Hardcore Compost and one of the worker owners. I also worked for the owner of the previous iteration of this company, Ivy Young, who founded Santa Cruz Community Composting.
And what did you do before you started doing that? What inspired you to get involved in something like this?
I think that I've thought of as worker cooperatives as a really important sort of tool for working people to have jobs that meet their needs, that pay them better than other jobs, where they have control over the working conditions that they're operating in, you know, where they have dignity and choice. And you know, I got really involved with another worker-owned cooperative, PedEx Courier and Cargo, also here in Santa Cruz. It's a worker-owned and operated bicycle courier business. I worked for there for a few years. And then when, you know, and I had worked for Santa Cruz Community Composting before then. And so when SCCCO, a lot of C's in there, the previous company shut down due to some injuries, and the owner approached myself and another previous worker had been in discussion with her before about what it would look like as a co-op, and we got back in conversation with her and ended up negotiating a sale and restarted her company as Hardcore Compost.
Okay. Kumi, how about
you? Hi, my name is Kumi. I'm not one of the original members of Hardcore Compost, not one of the founding members, but I've been working here for a little over a year now. And before this, I think what really drew me to this job was just real interest in working outdoors and really having a connection to the work that you're doing, mm-hmm. that's not just sort of menial, but mm-hmm. really has meaning. Mm-hmm. Before this, when I was a student at UC Santa Cruz, I worked at the Arboretum, so mm-hmm. I just really loved being outdoors, and that was what really drew me to this position. And then what has really engaged me since then is the worker-owned aspect of it. I've learned a lot through this about running a business and just also having a job where, you, like Zav said, you have a say in your workplace and you really have an investment in your work that you're doing and an integrity in that work beyond just showing up and working for someone else, more or less.
Well, I would like to talk more about the sort of management structure, but before we do that, why don't you describe for our listeners what we're looking at here?
Okay. Sure. Kumi, do you want to
be descriptive, right?
Yeah, so we're out here on the west side, sort of by Natural Bridges. If you've ever been to Homeless Garden Project Farm, or right next to here, there's a lot of wide open space.
You can see the UC Marine Sciences campus just to the south of us.
Yeah, we're a little east of Wilder Ranch. And yeah, we've got this pretty big flat area out here, and on our little spot in this, what we've got are some sort of concentric half circles of big piles. They're maybe about a little smaller than a car, about half the size of a car. And what these piles are, where we do our composting. They're in rings, like I said, so we've got the outer ring, which is the first piles that get built after with the food scraps you collect. And then after, how many weeks is it, Zav?
I think we give them...
Let's get back to that later, because I want to walk around and have you sort of tell us what you're doing.
Mm-hmm.
So let's go back to the beginning. I mean, how much land do you have out here?
We're not on a very large space. I measured it recently. I think we have about, like, from this light post here to the RV there, and then back to, like, just behind that tent.
So it's less than an acre. Right?
Oh yeah, less than an acre.
Yeah. How did you get? I know this property is owned by Ron Swenson, mm-hmm. who's been trying to build a housing development mm-hmm. here for now 22 years mm-hmm. at least.
Mm-hmm.
A solar based housing development, mm-hmm. and with. Well, we won't talk about his luck, but how did you manage to get started here? What was the secret?
Yeah, so before Hardcore Compost existed, when it was Santa Cruz Community Composting Company, the previous owner, Ivy, actually had an agreement with the Homeless Garden Project to use some of the space that they were leasing.
I see.
And so the piles were initially just to the east of us, a little bit northeast, more in Homeless Garden Project's field. Mm-hmm. It was a much smaller system than only four pallets arranged crosswise, mm-hmm. so that there were four sort of quadrants uh-huh. that piles could be rotated through. And when what Ivy was picking up got too unmanageable for that system, she spoke with Homeless Garden Project, is my understanding. Maybe she'll call into the show and correct me. They were like, yeah, you know, use the space just south of our, mm-hmm. just south of our farm. We got in touch with Ron last year because we were concerned about the longevity of us using the space,
right.
because there have been all these discussions around Homeless Garden Project moving up to the Poganip.
Right.
And, you know, we wanted to make sure we would still have tenure here, a space to do our work, because it's hard to move several tons of compost, you know, on short notice. So we approached Ron and we worked out a lease, and he's very generous, mm-hmm, you know, in mm-hmm. letting us use the space. I think he supports what we're trying to do. We're here for the foreseeable future.
Okay. Well, how does the company work? I mean, what is it that you actually, you know, do?
Yeah.
Tell us about that.
So the six of us, collect kitchen scraps, mm-hmm. primarily. Any other compostable material too, but primarily kitchen scraps from about 330 or so, yeah, 330 customers. Wow. Spread throughout the area.
Yeah.
We do all of our door-to-door collection by bicycle, mm-hmm. with trailers. We have e-bikes now, which is a big improvement. Hauling all of that with manual bikes is quite a challenge.
Yeah.
And we do a collection every day of the week. Mm-hmm. And customers get a pickup once a week, depending on what region of the city they live in. Mm-hmm. We transfer everything into our company truck. And then on Thursdays, we come to our site, we unload the truck, and we build a new pile with what we've collected.
So every week you're building a new pile?
Every week we're building a new pile.
Okay. Uh-huh.
In total, what we collect, excluding the condominium service we do, because we don't have a way to weigh that yet, but excluding the condominium service we do, we're collecting on average about 3,000 pounds a week.
Mm-hmm. Do customers have buckets or something?
We give everyone a 5-gallon bucket.
5-gallon
when
bucket.
They sign up. And we've actually started getting into the recycling stream a little bit with that, because there are a couple of grocery stores that have delis that, you know, they get, and the bakery too,
yeah.
gives us buckets. Mm-hmm. You know, these 5-gallon, 4-gallon plastic buckets aren't recyclable. They don't go into the recycling waste stream the way like a water bottle would.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And so we've started collecting those and reusing those, you know, because they're perfectly good buckets that were used to hold pickles for, you know, a month.
Do you swap out buckets every week?
We clean them. Yeah, when we're there, we clean the bucket with vinegar. We swipe it out with newspaper. And then we reline it with a fresh paper bag.
Got it. Okay. And, are there any kind of metrics about, you know, how much a customer produces a week? I have a compost bin at mm-hmm. home, right? And I think I empty it about 3 times a week, but it's a small one. I think it's like 2 gallons.
Mm-hmm.
Is 5 gallons sort of what people produce? And that would be what? Mm-hmm. 5 gallons times, that's about 40 pounds, right?
What do you think, Kumi?
Do you know?
Yeah, depending on the material that people put, if they're putting like wet coffee grounds and like, versus if they're putting dried up bread, the weight can vary between 10 to 30 pounds per bucket usually.
Okay.
And some, you know, it really does vary from household to household how full they are, just depending on people's lifestyles, how much produce they're using a mm-hmm. week, and other things. But we do also collect like those sort of, what's it called? Compostable takeout containers and things mm-hmm. like that.
Compostable plastics.
And you succeed in composting them?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's our understanding, at least from our...
Well, we did that experiment, right?
Mm-hmm.
But the question is, do they actually biodegrade, or do they just break down into little pieces of... microscopic pieces of plastic? I don't know if we ever determine that.
Yeah, I don't know if we ever did a full test of that that part of it.
Yeah,
they do fall apart.
I know that for certain.
Mm-hmm.
But the question, of course, is, fall apart as what?
These
microscopic pieces of plastic, or do they biodegrade into H, C, and O, mm-hmm. right? Basically, which is what you'll H. CO2 and O.
You know, any
oxygen?
Any soil scientists at the university you want to hook us up with, Ronnie?
Didn't we do some soil testing a while ago?
Yeah, I don't know if they would find that in the specific tests that we were doing, because ours was mainly for nutrient content
biological
activity.
I don't know if anybody is doing that kind of work, but it's worth probably looking into.
Because to the naked eye, they are. Gone,
no,
but
I
it's
know,
hard to
know
if they really are.
I know, but I mean, the city takes its stuff and sends it off to Monterey, to Seaside, or I think over to Hill. And I want to ask you about that a little bit later on.
Yeah,
about
we can
the new
get into
program,
that.
Just you know, mm-hmm. But apparently, you know, the varieties of plastic matter. I mean, we've had a couple of shows about this. We had mm-hmm. Tim Gontroff on in December, and then about a year ago, Kevin Bell talked at some length about this mm-hmm. on one of the shows. But, okay, why don't we just do a walkthrough, okay?
Yeah.
You said there's 6 of you?
Yeah.
Okay, we'll come back and talk about the about that. So we're going over to the compost piles.
Maybe we can go to the newest one.
Why don't we start with the newest one? And
This compost pile got built last Thursday, and then we topped it off on Friday.
Why don't you describe it for the audience?
Yeah,
what does it look
so
like?
We've got this long, low mound. It's about maybe 2.5-3 feet high. It's covered, and it's maybe
five, six
feet wide.
Yeah, they're like 6 by 10 usually.
Yeah. Yeah, okay.
And then it's covered in straw. It's totally coated in straw. And
what's underneath it? The stuff, all of the organic stuff.
Yeah. Right? So
under the straw. Okay.
Pull it back a little bit so we can have a look. So here we go. Here are food scraps.
I see onions and then other identifiable stuff.
It is also quite hot.
Yeah.
How hot does it get?
We get up to around 155 Fahrenheit. Within the piles, and we do maintain that temperature.
It's too bad you don't have a need for hot water out here, because down at Whiskey Hill Farms, what Dave Bloom does down there is he runs pipes through his compost to heat water to warm the greenhouses that he has.
Yeah.
You know?
That would be pretty cool to do.
I've always wondered about, you know, is there a way to do this for people who have backyard composting so they can heat water?
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, go on. Yeah.
Yeah. So we've got the whole thing covered as well with canvas covering. It just helps keep moisture in.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a lot of coyotes out here, so.
Yeah, I was wondering about beasties.
Yeah, largely the piles get left alone. We do have to rebuild them sometimes because the coyotes do get under the covers and like rip the piles apart sometimes. But when they're well covered, it's not a huge deal.
And no problems with rats.
We have ground squirrels and mice that nest in the straw.
Mm-hmm.
But
nothing worse.
Nothing worse, as far as we've seen.
Uh-huh.
They don't tend to cause much disruption to the piles. They'll dig a little hole, but the piles are pretty large, so they don't do much.
So what's going on inside there?
Kumi, you want to talk a bit about?
Yeah, sure. So we use a sort of layering process for building our piles to incorporate the food scraps and also wood chips and things like that. So we'll put down a layer of food scraps and then a layer of wood chips and leaf material and things like that, and then just layer them all the way up. And that's just to create a balanced amount of carbon and nitrogen, because essentially what's going on in here is there are just tons and tons of microorganisms that are taking the nutrients that are locked in the food scraps that, you know, it's too late for us to get them by eating it, so we got to get them out some other way. And the microorganisms do that through taking the carbon and the nitrogen as well as water and oxygen, and that's what drives their metabolic processes. And then they break down all of the material and unlock those nutrients and eventually turn it into soil. The science behind it is, you know, there are tons of microorganisms present everywhere, and so when you give them a bunch of stuff to eat and the proper conditions, like again with the moisture and the aeration, we put pipes underneath them with holes in it so the air comes in from the sides and aerates them, and then as we turn them it re-aerates them every few weeks or so. And that just sort of gives the perfect environment for a host of microorganisms as well as bigger things like bugs to get to work. And it sort of goes in phases. You get your first phase of microorganisms that operate around 50, 60 degrees Fahrenheit. And they come in, and as they are just doing all this work, breaking it down, that's where all the heat comes from. If you hear when it starts to get darker or when it's real cold in the winter, you'll see the piles steaming from all the heat. Yeah. And that's just a byproduct of their metabolic processes.
Mm-hmm.
And as they're working up a sweat, so to speak, in there, the temperature rises, and eventually they kind of put themselves out of commission by creating a temperature conditions that are no longer hospitable to that first round of microorganisms, but then a second round comes in. They kind of like these higher temperatures. Mm-hmm. And then they break everything down until they run out of things, and then the temperature will drop again, and then a third round of microorganisms will come in. Mm-hmm. And then that process happens over generally like 4 to 6 weeks. And after that time, we turn our piles, re-aerate them, sometimes add a little moisture if they're seeming a bit dry. And then that process will start all over again. And it goes through 1, 2, 3, 4 cycles of turning until the stuff is broken down enough to sift. And then we have our soil. It pretty much just looks like dirt.
How long does the entire composting cycle take? Because you said you turn over four times, right? Every 4 or 6 weeks?
It's 4 to 6 weeks to turn the initial piles. And then, I think
it's about 4 months.
4 months or so?
Four months
from start to finish. And then we sift it out, and we got this sort of sifting contraption that one of our members built. Uh-huh. And so everything that falls through, about...
quarter inch
or smaller is what we have as our finished product. Mm-hmm. And then the rest of the bigger chunks that, you know, more woody bits generally that take longer to decompose, they just get incorporated back into the piles and go through again.
Mm-hmm. Okay, all right.
One thing I wanted to add about why the turning is necessary is I said that this pile was about 3-ish feet high. This pile was probably up to my chest, so probably like 4, 4.5 feet.
When it was built.
Oh, yeah. Wow. Uh-huh. So all of the, like, all the work that the microorganisms and insects and you know, other organisms that are living in the piles are doing, they're really breaking up the structure of the material we're putting in. So like your broccoli stem, for example, they're going to hollow it out and it'll collapse flat, and so the whole pile just kind of settles, and it closes off all the air space. In the pile. It closes off space for air and water to travel. No oxygen
nested,
for them.
Yeah.
And so that's part of, too, why we have to turn the pile, jumble it all up, and give it those air spaces again.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And so basically what you've got is microorganisms eating and pooping, and then next generation does the same thing. And right. Do you have earthworms in here, too?
We have earthworms in the cooler parts of the pile. They don't like the
hot. Yeah.
In our piles that are resting, that are like more decomposed, we tend to have earthworms in the later stages.
Okay. Well, so this row here, there's a row here of three mounds. This is these are all sort of what in the first stages.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so these ones, we're gonna have one more built, I think, right here, and then then we're going to turn, the next ones to be turned are going to be these two. They're going to get combined. So we have two in our outer ring. They get combined. When they get turned, at the same time. They get combined into the next, into one pile in the next inner ring.
Okay, I see. Okay. And here's a labor question.
Yeah.
How do you do the turning?
By hand. Pitchforks and shovels. Yep.
Yeah. So it sounds like you could use a little tractor of some sort.
We've talked about it.
I mean, that would be, I guess it makes you stronger. Huh?
Yeah.
As well. Okay, so now we're at, what, the second?
This would be the third row. Right now there's none in the second row.
Okay.
Because they just have been recently turned.
What's the difference between then the first row and the second row?
It's just more decomposed and just needing to be jumbled up so it gets re-aerated.
Okay.
Yeah. Uh-huh. I mean, we can show you some of the second round one. We have them on over on this side. You can see.
Yeah. So these, there's only three here, but there'll be one more. So each outer ring will get turned into two in the second ring. That two in the second ring will get turned into one in the third ring.
Mm-hmm.
So they're kind of folding in on each other.
So this pile was, I kid you not, again, like 5 feet high. It's lost like 2 feet in height since we turned this.
Is that water or structure? That's.
I think it's structure largely. Uh-huh. I mean, you know, we throw everything on top of, on top. You know, we turn everything over, and I think things are settling out and also losing their structure. So they're falling off, they're falling into the cracks between each other, they're crushing each other.
Actually, you know, what I notice is I keep putting stuff in my backyard compost bin and it never fills up.
Ooh, you should feel this. This is really getting up there.
Ah, yeah. This is quite warm. What would you say? 100? 100?
I mean, it's steaming. It's not entirely pleasant to touch. I mean, I would say I'd get, you know, this is close to what comes out of your hot water tap.
And you can...
Oh, I don't think it's quite that hot, but all right. Maybe 110.
To describe for the listeners, too, when we pull back this layer of straw on the outside, it's this material has been decomposing for about 6 weeks, and it's pretty unrecognizable as... previously was. It's just a bunch, looks very brown, and a lot of it has like white stuff on the outside that looks like mold, but it's actually another kind, it's just a type of bacteria that likes to eat it at this stage of the process.
For our listeners, I just put my finger a little bit farther into the pile, and yes, it is certainly the temperature of hot water.
Yeah, it's
hot water from a water heater. No,
couldn't stick your finger in there for long.
No, it's quite warm.
So you can still see things like there's some pumpkin seeds in here. Uh-huh. They haven't broken down. Those are probably going to get sifted and run back through the pile with the overs. We get a lot of things like pumpkin seeds, pistachio hulls.
Things that are,
you know, chunks of wood, things that are woodier and tougher.
Yeah.
That need another round or so. Coconut shells, they need a couple rounds.
Yeah, so here you can see this.
This is the air.
The air pipe. So this pipe here has got a bunch of holes drilled in it.
Mm-hmm.
So the air comes in from the outside and then goes through those holes into the different parts of the pile.
Because these piles get so big, we've got one aeration about halfway up, and then one that's on the ground that we lay down before we start turning the pile. Yeah, please.
If you were actually pushing air through the pipes, would that speed up the process? I mean, is oxygen a limiting factor here, or is it?
It can speed the process up. Sure. There are sort of industrial composting setups that do that mm-hmm. have like various kinds of ways of introducing air through blowers or through vacuums, like pulling air through the pile.
Mm-hmm.
And it can speed up processing time.
So this is the second.
This is the second round.
All right.
Second turn.
Yeah, and...
This would be turn three.
This is three, all right.
This needs to be watered. It's dry.
So here it's really starting to look like dirt with chunks of other things in it.
And it's much cooler. It's quite, it's not actually warm at all.
Yeah.
But this is still, the bacteria, microorganisms are still at work here, right?
Yep, pretty much. Uh-huh. You know, you could leave a pile of stuff and pay no mind to how much water is in it, pay no mind to its conditions, and it would break down over time, eventually. But what we try to do through really tending our piles and setting them up with the tubes and other things like that is create an optimal situation for them to move through their decomposition cycle. So at any temperature stage, there are still microorganisms and bugs in there doing their work.
Okay. And then... And is there a fourth pile?
The fourth pile just got sifted this week. So it was here. All of that stuff in that big brown pile over there is the things that we sifted out.
Okay.
Then this was, you can see kind of the footprint of this. This was a huge pile.
Mm-hmm.
It took probably about 8 hours to sift through all of it. Similar to the third round.
Yeah. Just if you get further in, you can see, you know, largely what's still recognizable is, what's this? We got like a peach pit or something, maybe an avocado pit, chunks of wood chips, little bits of like, people put their oyster shells in here, those are recognizable. But for the most part, you know, you're not looking at any you're not seeing like a kale leaf or, you know, a lettuce or anything like that. Yeah. It's mostly woody material that's still identifiable.
Do you do paper too in here?
We do. Like this is probably one of the brown paper bags that we line the bins with. Yeah. Those have to go through a few times too. They get kind of matted, and then you have to pull them apart so that the microorganisms can actually access all the material.
Okay.
Yeah, we try to optimize the surface area too. Like if someone throws in an entire like huge cantaloupe or a pumpkin, it's going to take a long time for that to break down. But if we break it into smaller pieces, then we really increase the surface area that the microorganisms can get at it from.
And the inner stuff, the stuff inside is what they want. Anyway. Yeah.
Should we look at some freshly sifted soil?
Yeah, let's. Well, actually, why don't you? So someone built this sifter here. Mm-hmm. Why don't you describe this to us?
We inherited this from the previous owner, and we've got a steel frame. It's roughly rectangular, with two bicycle wheels at one end on the floor and two casters at the other end on the floor, and then sort of suspended at chest height or so. Is this this trommel? It's a cylindrical screen, and it's powered by a treadmill motor. And so we hook up a 12-volt battery to this, and it spins the screen. And as the screen is spinning, we're shoveling, we're shoveling the pile that's ready to be sifted, into this sheet metal funnel at one of the mouths of the cylinder.
Mm-hmm.
And so since the cylinder is a screen, the smaller materials are falling through the openings in it, and then the larger undecomposed material is falling out the other end.
Out the other end, yeah. Okay.
And so we collect what falls through the screen, we put it in a pile, and we collect it, and over a period of time, we return it to the customers who subscribe to the service.
Okay. And so what does this look like?
So the piles are covered in a material. It's like a kind of a felt material that helps regulate moisture and temperature. And there you have it. It's very, it just looks like garden soil, you know. It
smells
very
good too.
It's dark. It's got a fairly regular size of grains. You can see the occasional peanut shell or very small stick or scrap of paper that escaped the sifter. Before we return it to customers, we do pick these out because we're filling bags for return by hand. So we pick these little bits out. But for the most part, it's, you know, if you looked at healthy garden soil, you might go, oh, well, that looks just about the same as what's in the pile.
Great. Yeah. So you return the stuff to the customers.
Yeah. Do you want to talk about how we do that a bit, Camille?
Yeah. Sure. We take it from here back to our site, and when we're setting up for our routes, we have it marked on our sheet of houses we're going to stop by that day, which customers have requested soil, and once a month we fill up a bag for them. It's
a little over a gallon.
Yeah, a little over a gallon of soil, and we take it back to the customers. A lot of our customers have gardens or, you know, house plants.
Yeah. You're doing this here, right? This, or you just mentioned.
Oh, sorry. We have an office that we take a portion of it back to.
Where is that?
So we are adjacent to the bike church in downtown Santa Cruz. We have an office in the same sort of courtyard
as them. You take the soil back down there, and that's where you bag it.
Yeah, that's where we keep our trailers and set up for our routes.
So that raises the question of, you know, you start out with, how much did you say you collect a week?
About 3,000 pounds.
About 3,000 pounds. How much comes out at the end?
We'd estimated before that we get like a times 8 loss in volume. We're putting out, it was like 250 gallons a month, at least. We're returning about 250 gallons a month of soil to customers.
Yeah,
we have a bit more soil than that, but we don't have an exact figure on that. We just kind of have that 250 gallons returned each month to customers.
That's interesting. Okay, so you're a worker-owned company. not a collective.
We're a worker-owned cooperative.
Cooperative. Okay.
Yeah.
I want to make sure I got the terms right.
Sure.
So you're incorporated under the California law, basically?
We're incorporated as an LLC.
Uh-huh.
And each member is an equal partner in the business.
Right, yeah.
But the reason we use the term cooperative is there are certain... there are certain sort of tenets of like cooperativism,
right.
I guess you could say, that we run the business by.
The reason I asked is I looked into worker-owned cooperatives
mm-hmm.
last year,
mm-hmm.
And there's a California law, right? I mean, mm-hmm. these are legally constituted under California law.
Mm-hmm.
Do you have shareholders at all? Community shareholders?
No. Nope.
You haven't tried to do something like that? Because you're allowed to, maybe you know this,
mm-hmm.
you're allowed to sell shares. I think it's the maximum is 10 shares or $1,000, and you don't have to go to the SEC and mm. do all of the registration stuff.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and I don't know how much capital it could provide, but,
mm-hmm.
You know, it's just something that I learned about.
Yeah.
As well. Yeah.
We haven't done much of looking into raising more capital for the business. At this point, we're sort of keeping things running and slowly growing just based on the regular operations.
Yeah.
We are able to post a profit,
uh-huh.
luckily for us. Here, and that's one aspect of the worker cooperative structure that, you know, is good for us, is that when there is a profit in the company, on top of base wages that we pay ourselves, we distribute the profits to the workers,
right,
based
yeah.
on this concept called patronage,
yeah.
which basically means, in the context of a worker cooperative, if you work, say, 25% of the hours needed for the operation of the company in a year, then you receive 25% of the profits
uh-huh.
that the company makes at the end of the year.
Does that provide an incentive for people to work as much as they can, to do as much as they can? I mean, you know, it sounds a bit like, you know, if you want to get a bigger chunk of what's of the profit, right,
mm-hmm.
you've got to do more patronage.
Mm-hmm. I think everyone kind of has their own motivations.
I'm just curious about it.
Yeah, it definitely does, in a way, acknowledge the efforts that
yeah.
you put towards the company and acknowledge and respect that if you are really like giving tons and tons of hours and doing tons of shifts, that you will see that reflected in your profit.
Mm-hmm.
But another part of, I think, the co-op structure is that we really do try to accommodate to our workers' needs and shifting schedules,
yeah, sure.
and
yeah.
provide everyone a working environment that is best fitted for their needs.
Yeah, so, mm-hmm. you know, you're not going to get hit with the schedule, with like being scheduled by your boss when you're trying to go to, I don't know, your cousin's wedding or something like that. Or,
yeah.
you
Lots
know,
of when flexibility.
You, yeah, a lot of flexibility, a lot of understanding from your coworkers. I think a lot of willingness to on each other's parts to like make space for each other, because
mm-hmm.
you know, we all depend on each other.
Yeah,
you know, it's
sure.
not just that, you know, I need to work with you because you know, we both got hired at this company and whatever. It's we're, you know, we're mutually responsible for each other. We're mutually responsible for the business. Yeah, I think that's a real benefit to working in a cooperative, because at least this kind of cooperative.
Do you take on new members if somebody's really interested in doing it?
Yeah. We have done some hiring recently. We've had members leave recently, and so we've hired. And then as the company grows, you know, if our current members don't have the capacity to attend to the labor needs that we have, then we do consider hiring new members.
Mm-hmm. And how's the company managed? I mean, what's the management structure of a cooperative like this?
Do you want to talk about company?
Yeah, sure. Pretty yeah. much in addition to doing all of the labor, all of the bicycle collection and the pile turning and all of that, we all are responsible additionally for all of the administrative needs of the business. And we do that through a clerkship system. So, for example, my clerkship is the customer service, customer contact. Mm-hmm. So, as our customers email us or call us on the phone, it's my responsibility to get to them and answer their questions. One of Zov's clerkships is to make the schedule every month, and we have other things that come up, not regularly, but quarterly or yearly. Our members also are, like, making quarterly reports, end-of-year economic reports.
Michael's doing the, consumables,
yeah,
the stocking clerkship, you know, making sure we have cleaning supplies for our buckets, making sure we have tires for the company's bikes, you know, that sort of thing. We have another person who's responsible for maintenance, making sure the bikes are running well, keeping our truck operable. There's different tasks that we basically leave each other, you know, to do the tasks, and we're not, like, micromanaging each other. But we are responsible for making sure that they happen, you know.
How does the group make decisions?
We have meetings every 2 weeks. Decisions are made by consensus. So if there is something that someone proposes that another member does not agree with, it doesn't move forward. We do have to be...
So one veto is sufficient to
one,
stop.
One veto is sufficient.
Oh, okay.
It hasn't come to... we haven't really gotten to any points where that's been really severe. You know, we do have disagreements, we do have situations where people are like, maybe I want to see this particular aspect of this idea fleshed out, or I understand what you're trying to do here, but what if we did it a slightly different way, or can you explain this more? We very rarely had someone putting their foot down, as it were. I think that there's, again, like, my experience of the cooperative is that there's a lot of trust within it, and that we, you know, we have space to disagree with each other. And then we also just trust each other to, like, be acting in the interests of the cooperative.
Are there other companies like yours across the country? I mean, are you...
Cooperatives or composting...
Composting cooperatives.
There is one in Los Angeles that I just found out about. It's called the Los Angeles... It's like LA Worm Farm or LA Worm Compost Collective. And they are similarly a cooperatively structured composting company. Specifically, they're doing vermicomposting.
Yeah.
So they're processing the material they get using worms.
Okay. Well, so let's talk about the elephant in the room, which is, and I should explain this a little bit, that there's a new California law that requires that all jurisdictions provide organic waste collection services to residents and businesses. And organic waste cover the gamut, which sort of surprised me. It includes organic textiles and carpets, digestate and sludges. I don't know what that means.
Things that come from biodigesters or sewage treatment plants.
Well, anyway, the city is going to be handing out 6-gallon pails to customers. I mean, have you been talking to the city about this or working with them?
We have been in communication with the city since we started, pretty much. We've been just, you know, talking to them and sort of making ourselves known about, to them.
Are you going to be playing any role in this new program? I mean, what's the business situation look like, right? Because, I mean, I'm assuming everyone's going to get the 6-gallon bucket, right? It's internalized in what they pay for garbage service, right? So it's not free, but in fact, it's an add-on.
Yeah.
Do you have any idea what this is going to, you know, how is it going to impact your business?
It's not clear right now. We are trying to, you know, figure out a way to work with the city and to be part of the overall system of dealing with organic waste and diverting organic materials from the landfill. we're hoping to enter into some kind of agreement with the city so that we can continue operating and continue growing as a business. Mm-hmm. We think that there's a lot of things going for us in terms of the city supporting us. You know, one is that we're doing it all locally, so that not just the fact that we're, you know, not transporting the material we're collecting a long distance with, you know, a petroleum-fueled vehicle. We're actually, you know, recycling the material within the bounds of the city, we think is one benefit. There's also the local economic aspect, right, where we are a local business. We have existed, you know, I would argue for close to 8 years if you take into account that we inherited the structure from Santa Cruz Community Composting Company, you know, and we are providing green jobs in a city that is really starved for positions that can pay a decent wage, that have opportunities for advancement and growth, that are outside of the service sector. And even within that sector, you know, there really isn't much in terms of good long-term jobs, you know.
Do you know where the city is going to be sending its organic waste? Do you have any idea?
Yeah, they're going to be sending it to two different processing facilities. One is in Santa Clara, I believe, where one aspect of their program as well is that they are accepting food waste, but they're not accepting things like takeout containers or the like, because their two-fold processing structure, neither of those are actual compost in the way that we're doing it here and breaking it down into compost soil. So some of it they will be sending, trekking over to Santa Clara, and it's going to be turned into this sort of dehydrated animal feed for like large-scale agricultural livestock. And then the other sector of it, they're going to be sending to the wastewater treatment plant here in Santa Cruz, and the byproduct of that is biogas, which they will then be using. It's sort of like a sum zero operation. The biogas generates electricity that they're then using to power the technology that's turning it into biogas.
And the rest of the wastewater treatment.
Correct me if I'm wrong, but when you make biogas out of these materials, isn't there a residue that's left over? It doesn't all turn into gas.
What happens
to that?
That is the sludge and the sludge material that you were asking about earlier. Honestly, I don't know what the city.
I believe that
to Santa Clara.
Under the state bill,
maybe. I doubt it's going to go to Santa Clara because it's mixed in with the. Sorry to interrupt you.
No.
It's mixed in with all the toilet waste.
Sewage. Oh, okay.
Yeah.
So this is like the Watsonville, water waste treatment, where they have, they do tertiary treatment of their sewage, and then they turn it into biogas, but it leaves behind, well, I haven't been there in several years, enormous piles of residue. And because,
which could be composted.
Well, because it is human waste, it has toxic metals in it. And you can't put that on food crops. You can't put that on farmlands producing food. You could do that, you know, if you're producing something for animal feed or something else, but I don't know what they're doing. We're not very, you know, humans don't, because of all this stuff we ingest, are not very good for compost.
Yeah, under the state bill, it's, they have these calculations that what they're taking in and the way that they're processing it is, I'll wait till this.
Oh, go ahead, you know.
Okay. What they're taking in weight-wise and how they're processing it has to produce a byproduct that is less than a certain amount based on these calculations, which is then disposed of either at the landfill or other things, but it's reducing it in a certain...
reducing the amount of organic waste that is then taken to a landfill.
Yeah.
Their processing method is, it has to be doing that.
Yeah, so we're really hoping that our existing customers, and as we continue to try to grow our business, we'll see the benefits of composting, you know, on a community scale. Not to say that the methods that the city is using are inherently bad for dealing with large volumes, but that if people do have the means to do so by supporting, like Sob said, local green jobs and supporting a community compost effort that's then, you know, returning soil to them and doing actual composting, that there are social and environmental benefits to that as well. And as well as we plan to expand into doing education work, we received a grant from CalRecycle, and we're going to use that grant to sort of renovate our site a bit and make it a little more of a hospitable place to have
tourist worthy.
Yeah, to have events and educational events for like students, educational events for the general public, for other compost people are interested in compost, and you know, since we have our system figured out, so
I would think the local angle would be could be a powerful one, right? To pursue.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Because you know, the idea that you're gonna ship this stuff out of the county and then it's someone else's problem, pay money and then it's someone else's problem,
mm-hmm.
you know, strikes me as not being the ideal solution.
Yeah, and I mean, you know, it's not a zero-sum game here. It's like there's plenty of garbage.
Yeah.
You know, we just want to, you know,
we
just want some of it. We would really like to just be part, again, of this overall, you know, ecosystem, if you will, of like addressing the issue of organic waste.
You know, somewhere in the law there was, or somewhere in the description there's something about also reducing food waste.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's this hierarchy of ways to divert organic waste, and the first thing on the hierarchy is to not produce, you know,
not overproduce, not overpurchase, and then make sure if you have to make sure that someone gets to eat that food rather than it getting thrown out.
Yeah.
I think community scale composting is right below food reclamation and redistribution.
Well, is there anything else you want to add to what we've talked about?
I would just encourage people to check us out if this interview has been interesting. Our website is www.compost.bike. Again, www.compost.bike. Shoot us an email, give us a call if you have any questions. Come by our processing site during normal hours. Those are 2 p.m. to 5 p.m. on Fridays.
On Mondays.
Sorry. 2 p.m. to 5 p.m. on Mondays and 12 p.m. to 4 p.m. on Fridays. So
yeah.
I'll repeat that. 2 p.m. to 5 p.m. Mondays, 12 p.m. to 4 p.m. Fridays.
And why don't you repeat the location?
We are on Schaefer Road, on the west side of Santa Cruz, just south of the Homeless Garden Project. You take Delaware west, about as far as you can take it. You'll turn right up Schaefer Road, and we'll be on your right-hand side.
Okay. Well, listen, Sob and Kumis, thank you so much for being on Sustainability Now. And I wish you success, big, great success in your endeavors.
Thank you.
Yes, thank you for having us.
Appreciate it.
Okay.
One day a buzzard fell out of the sky. The final words he spoke we can't deny. Whether man or bird or elephant, we will all become trace elements. Yes, we'll all turn to compost by and by. By and by.
By and by.
By and by. Yes, we'll all turn to compost by and by. When our souls are all